From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A flamboyant theater producer has come to the violent town of Deadwood, where he plans to transform a bordello into a theater. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Brian Cox about his new recurring role on the HBO series Deadwood and about a stage and screen career. He co-starred in Woody Allen's Matchpoint and Spike Lee's 25th Hour, and he played Hannibal Lecter before Anthony Hopkins did. Also, how worsening allergies and an increase in asthma, poison ivy, and West Nile virus may be linked to global warming. We talk with Dr. Paul Epstein, Associate Director of Harvard Medical School's Center for Health and the Global Environment. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD from singer-songwriter Jolie Holland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Culture is coming to Deadwood. Last night on the HBO Western series, a flamboyant theater producer and his troupe arrived in this violent, anarchic Western town. He plans to transform an old bordello into a theater. The producer is played by my guest, Brian Cox. In addition to his recurring role on Deadwood, Cox is starring in a London production of a new Tom Stoppard play. Cox is a Scottish actor whose recent movies include Woody Allen's Match Point, Spike Lee's 25th Hour, The Bourne Supremacy, and L.I.E. Before Anthony Hopkins played Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs, Cox played Hannibal Lecter in the 1986 movie Manhunter. Let's start with a scene from an upcoming episode of Deadwood. The theater producer, Jack Langrish, is dividing the members of his troupe into committees.
Civic relations is me, and we'll include here a subcommittee for the renovation of the bordello. Supervision of the work, subcommittee head, countess, done. With thanks. Civic relations, construction subcommittee, Claudia. Countess is the second.
Hiring laborers.
A truth divinely writ. We make more devotees of theater, engaging 20 laborers at $2 apiece than two of the same at 20.
That's a scene from Deadwood. Brian Cox, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your character in Deadwood.
I play a character called Jack Langrish. He's a character who actually existed. He's slightly different from the real character. He's different in this way, that he was actually very, very low-key. He was quite low-key. He wasn't as flamboyant as perhaps I have, or David Milch has made him. And he's serving a clear purpose in the story of Deadwood. But he was an amazing man, because he was a man who toured theatre companies all over America during that particular time. And he had just lost everything and actually kind of like out of the ashes at the Chicago fire, he lost his company, and then within a week he had everything back on its feet again. He started off touring with about 15 people. He ended up touring with 115 people. He finally retired and he died as a senator, I think, in Colorado. He was a really, really interesting man, and he was the first person to really bring theater to the West. He actually did, in Deadwood itself, he did the American premiere of The Mikado.
Oh, God. Register on me to think of The Mikado in Deadwood. The way Deadwood is portrayed in the series is really hysterical.
Yeah, it is. It's a kind of, it's so odd, really. But it was fascinating. He was a fascinating character. And so he comes now to Deadwood, and basically I think, you know, we've arrived in the third series, and you know, if you look at the sort of graph and the path of Deadwood, you can see that culture, you know, having been through the whores and the boozing and what have you, and the kind of more basic things that was required in those mining camps, the miners themselves, of course, sought culture. They wanted theatre. They wanted, you know, they wanted burlesque, but they also wanted straight theatre. So, you know, language serves a need.
Because your character is a man of the theatre and very into theatre, when he's just having a conversation, he often sounds like he's proclaiming on a Shakespearean stage. You've performed in Shakespearean productions. What is the difference between how you actually perform Shakespeare when you're doing Shakespeare and this kind of Shakespearean sound that you've given this theatrical producer in Deadwood?
Well, it's to do with the technique of how to speak, for a start, how to sustain a thought on one breath. Shakespeare is all about breath as thought, but a lot of his cadence is very, very long. You know, the iambic carries you through, and I mean, there's a whole structure to how you play verse. But also the idea is that everything is on the text. You know, the subtextual idea is a very, very 20th century idea, and it's a kind of thing that pervades American films, which is why we have this kind of Strasbourgian effect, you know, this kind of, I think, basically phony Stanislavskiism, where the actors scratch and mumble and do what this stuff, and that's supposed to be real, you know. But the interesting thing about somebody like Langrish is his language and his training and his craft and his appreciation of words infects him. And you get that with theatric types. I mean, it's slightly dying out in the way it was now, but I work, for instance, with John Gielgud, I work with Ralph Richardson, I also work with Laurence Olivier, and they had a cadence, they had an ability to use a phrase in a particularly erudite and extraordinary way. They were part of that breed of actor. And those Victorian actors excelled at it, absolutely excelled at it. It was the way they spoke. It was the way they thought. How they got up in the morning, that's what they started with till when they went to bed at night.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Cox, and he's one of the stars of the new season of Deadwood, and he plays a theatrical producer. I want to get to another role that you've had, and this is just such a terrific performance. It was in the film The 25th Hour in 2002. This is directed by Spike Lee, and I want to play a scene here. Edward Norton plays someone who's about to serve a long prison term, and the film is set in the 24 hours before he has to report to prison. And this is like the last scene of the film. You play his father, you own a bar, you're driving your son to the prison, down a long country road, driving him from the city to the country where the prison is. And his face is beaten raw. He's actually had somebody beat him up so that he wouldn't look too pretty or too weak and innocent when he got to prison. So he's sitting in the car with his face beaten up. You're driving, and then you say to him, just give me the word, and I'll take a left turn, and we'll find a nice little town that you can hide in instead of reporting to prison. So here's some of that scene we'll pick up right after you've made that offer.
If you want it, if that's what you want, I'll do it.
Oh, I'd take your bar.
My bar. Jesus, my bar. They can take my bar to hell and back. You think my bar is more important to me than you, my only child? Give me the word and we'll go.
They'll find me. They'll find me sooner or later.
You know how they find people? They find them when they come home. People run away, but they usually come back. That's when they get caught. So you go, and you never come back. You never come home. We'll drive. We'll keep driving. Head out to the middle of nowhere. Take that road as far as it takes us. You've never been west of Philly, have you? This is a beautiful country, Monty. It's beautiful out there. Looks like a different world. Mountains, hills, cows, farms, and white churches.
It's my guest, Brian Cox, with Edward Norton in a scene from the film The 25th Hour. That is such a beautiful scene, and it's as if you're reading a poem with music behind you. So, can you talk a little bit about doing that scene? Your monologue there lasts nearly 7 minutes.
It was an amazing thing. We the monologue was rewritten. It was actually rewritten on the day we recorded it. I mean, we did one version of it early on, and then we just did this other version because Spike fell in love with the whole idea of this, of the kind of redemption, regenerative, you know, thing that could happen to Ed's character. So he wanted more stuff. So David Benioff, who wrote the script and also wrote the original book, wrote this, I think it's in the end, it's about a 10-minute monologue, and it was quite amazing. And we just did it. You know, we did the scene, of course, with Ed and I, and then it goes in. It kind of makes a seamless change into the monologue. And it's just an extraordinary... I think it's a truly, truly extraordinary film because it deals with so much. Again, it deals with, you know, because it was the first film to deal with directly with 9/11 in a scene where the two boys are down in Lower Manhattan and Spike had the guts to kind of pan through the window and he looked right down at Ground Zero, and it kind of gave the film an edge and a whole paean and kind of homage to America. And when I hear that script now and I hear the fact of the celebrating of what is beyond Manhattan, what is beyond that place, it's just quite, it's so evocative and so poetic and so of the time. And, you know, I kind of really, I think it's a remarkable piece of work.
Brian Cox, you didn't really become well known in the States until you were in what, your 40s, when the film Manhunter came out in the 1980s. I think that was a kind of turning point in terms of American recognition.
Yeah, I was just in my it came out around about when I was, I made it when I was, I think, 39, and it came out when I was 40.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, you played Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter. What are some of the pluses and minuses of getting discovered by Hollywood when you're 40 as opposed to when you're in your teens or 20s?
Well, the thing, I think the obvious plus is that you're there. I mean, I've always wanted to be an actor for the long haul. I kind of realized that I started really quite young. I was 15 when I started to work in the theater, and I went to drama school when I was just 17. I did my audition when I was 16, and I was working as a professional actor from the age of 19. So, you know, I was very aware that, and I think it's my Scottish canniness, I think it's what stands me in good stead. I was very aware of the fact that I would be, you know, that while I know it's an insecure profession, it's something I want to be doing down the road. And the irony is, of course, as you get older, well, actually, it's not ironic, it's a fact of life. You know, experience comes to you. So the thing that's more interesting is as you get older, because you have been dealing with life. So in a way, your work gets richer and you know more about your job and you're able to offer more. And the most interesting work for me is the supporting work. You know, in the theatre, I'm a leading actor. And I will always go back to the theatre and assume that role, but I can do it less and less because it's expensive. But in the cinema, it's knowing where your place is and knowing that you want to be a supporting actor. So you come in and you give the colour to a movie in a way. You know, because I've got colleagues back in England who say, well, I could never play small parts in films, you know, or anything like that. And I just think it's a nonsense, really. I mean, Michael Powell once said the great thing about cinema is that there are no small parts or big parts. There are only short parts and long parts, i.e. you're on a film either for a long time or you're on it for a short time. But when you're on a film, whatever, you know, when you're there, that's you. You're doing it.
My guest is Brian Cox. He has a new recurring role in the HBO series Deadwood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brian Cox. He has a new recurring role on the HBO Western series Deadwood, playing a flamboyant theater producer. Cox is in London now, starring in the premiere of the new Tom Stoppard play Rock and Roll. I know your father died of cancer when you were 9, and your mother had some kind of breakdown and was institutionalized. Yeah. For how long was she institutionalized?
She was institutionalized for about, on and off, it was about 2.5 years, 2.5 to 3 years.
Was there ever a diagnosis?
Well, basically, she had, you know, she had a massive nervous breakdown, and she did try to commit suicide at one point, and I think just everything became too much for her, and she just completely physically and mentally collapsed, and they didn't know what to do with her for quite a while, and then they finally decided to give her electric shock treatment. So they gave her electric shock treatment over a period of about 6 or 7 months, and then she had to recover from that. So it was a kind of long, drawn-out process, and you know, it was quite, I think it was very difficult for her. It was a very painful time for her.
So you must have had it pretty rough. I mean, by the time you were 9 or 10, you were in some ways almost orphaned because your mother was institutionalized, your father had passed away.
Yeah, I had these wonderful sisters who, I have three elder sisters and I have a brother as well, a brother who's older than me. There's a kind of, the war is between us all. My sisters were born, I mean, I've got sisters who are 16, 15 years older than me. And they're still around. I mean, they're fantastic women, truly fantastic women. They were fantastic to me when I was a kid. I mean, they really were. They saved me. I mean, my childhood was great. I mean, in recent times I get a little bit, I get a little bit concerned because I seem to give the wrong message about my childhood. Actually, my childhood until my father died was really pretty amazing. I mean, my mother and father had problems, but they had problems which was to do with. My dad made some, you know, he during the war he did quite well because he had a tiny shop and he made some very bad building investments and lost a lot of money, and that was in the background. But basically, we were a very happy family. And then my father, though my mother was always troubled, she as a young girl she'd gone to Canada and into service, and then she actually came back to marry my father. But I think she always regretted the fact that I think she was really the artistic one of the family. I think she regretted the fact that she gave up a life to, you know, have kids. And I think it was tough. I think it was a tough thing for working class women at that time. I think they, you know, my mother was one of millions, I think.
You left home when you were around 15.
I left home. I still lived in my home, but I was hardly ever there because I was working in the theater. I really left home when I was 17.
And did you leave home because you were unhappy there, or because you wanted to start looking at theater more seriously?
No. You know, when I left, it was really because I had a very strong accent, a very, very strong Dundonian accent, and I had to go to drama school. And I wanted to go to drama school, and really in order to learn the craft of acting. And I wanted to go to London because I didn't want to go to Glasgow. I really, you know, I needed somewhere where I could learn how to speak, you know, what they call standard English, which I've never been able to speak.
What do you think of your accent as sounding like now?
Well, my accent is a sort of hybrid of so many things. You know, I think I've lived in England for, you know, on and off most of my life, but I've also lived in America. I mean, it's been very difficult because I've got this line in this play. I'm doing this Stoppard play in London, and I've got this line where I say to the woman who plays my wife, just, you know, who's had cancer, I say, and she's had a breast remove, and I say, just don't lose half your bum, that's all. And I keep saying, but. I get told off very firmly by the, it's not but, it's bum.
What about the accent or the dialect that you're using in Deadwood as the theatrical producer?
Well, that was originally, you know, it was so odd because I originally was going to play him American, but then I realized that he was indeed Irish. And there was a wonderful actor called Michael McLeamore. Michael McLeamore was the man who gave Orson Welles his first job. Him and his lover, who was called Hilton Edwards, ran the Gate Theatre in Dublin in the 20s. And Orson Welles auditioned there when he was 16. And then Orson Welles finally cast Michael as Iago when he did the film of Othello. But Michael became this sort of grand dame because he was gay, but he was this very sort of, and he always wore full makeup, and he wore a black toupee. And actually, the irony was he wasn't really Irish, but he pretended to be Irish because he loved the Irish cadence. And he loved that way of speaking, that wonderful way of speaking in that Irish voice. And so I kind of thought this was a very good kind of template for Jack Langrish. So I kind of used a bit of that.
So you used the sound of somebody trying to
That's
sound.
That's right. He was the. Irish. I mean, okay. I'd seen Michael McLeamore. He used to do this show called, because was, you know, Oscar Wilde was an Irishman, called The Importance of Being Oscar, which was basically gave him an opportunity to play Lady Bracknell, but he always played Lady Bracknell with a very educated Irish accent.
Now, I've read that you've said that you don't like to watch your own movies, you don't like to see yourself on screen because it makes you feel like the Elephant Man. You said, I come across as a sort of creature. I never seem like a human being. And I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, it's funny. I've just been doing some ADR for Deadwood this morning.
ADR. And, what is ADR?
Looping. You know, doing some extra additional dialogue required is what ADR is. It's where, you know, it's where you dub yourself on a screen. You know, like they might change a line, and you have to, you know, you have to watch yourself on the screen, and there's a little white line goes across, and you play the line. So I had to see myself, and I just go, you know, it's just so odd. I think your own. You know, when you're in the mirror, you know, if you pass yourself in the mirror, you're still, or you see a photograph, you're still. But when you see yourself in motion, all kinds of, your face does all kinds of odd things and takes on odd shapes, and I get kind of spooked by it. I really do. My wife, she keeps saying, "No, you must watch your work. You know, you really must." And I did when I was younger. I did because I was vain, and I think it's still vanity that makes goes and goes. God, this guy's so ugly. You know, it is the elephant man.
You know, and what you're saying is true in your mind, but so untrue in reality. But yeah, the reason why I'm interested in this is that you're dealing with this as an actor, but I think like so many people just deal with this looking in the mirror in the morning. That it's just such a reaction that I think many of us have just looking in the mirror like that.
Exactly.
That's how I look.
Well, at least in the mirror you're still, but, you know, on screen you're moving.
Right. You even get to see how you look behind your ears and stuff.
That's
like
right,
that.
Yeah. And then you see angle.
Well, Brian Cox, I wish you good luck in the new play that you're in, and I look forward to seeing more of you in Deadwood, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a delight.
Brian Cox is in London, starring in the new Tom Stoppard play, Rock and Roll, and he now has a recurring role on the HBO series Deadwood. He plays theater producer Jack Langrish. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. angieslist.com. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how global warming may be linked to worsening allergies and increases in asthma, poison ivy, and mosquito-borne illness. We talk with Dr. Paul Epstein, Associate Director of Harvard Medical School's Center for Health and the Global Environment. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Springtime Can Kill You, the new album from Jolie Holland. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Allergies getting to you? Well, there's evidence that increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the air may be making some pollen-related allergies worse. Global warming may also be contributing to an increase in mosquitoes and mosquito-borne diseases and the growth of poison ivy. Here to explain the connection is Dr. Paul Epstein, Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. The center's goal is to promote a wider understanding of the health consequences of global environmental change. Epstein is a physician who has specialized in tropical diseases and public health. Let's start with the connection between climate change and worsening allergies to ragweed and pollen.
This is something that in the 1990s we did not imagine. We thought carbon dioxide, okay, one of the side effects is it could increase the forests and agriculture and green the earth. In fact, many of the skeptics about climate change touted carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels as something that would boost photosynthesis and brighten up the earth and generate more nutrition. What we found is that the weedy species are responding disproportionately. The opportunists, just as in the animal kingdom, we see some of the mosquitoes and the bugs and rodents responding, we see opportunistic species in the plant world, like poison ivy, responding to carbon dioxide, making more of itself, growing, and also making more toxic chemical within it that's more allergenic. We did experiments with carbon dioxide and ragweed here at Harvard, and they were repeated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We doubled CO2, two times CO2, and what we found was that the ragweed went up about 10%, but the pollen went up 60%. We're seeing ivy and weeds and plants that are opportunistic seize on this disturbance of more CO2, make more of themselves, and make more toxicity. And this is something that is happening in the plants, it's happening in the animals, it's happening in the oceans with more algae and jellyfish. And these are the ones that are seizing on the multiple stresses that the environment is undergoing because of human activities, be it habitat change or extra chemicals or climate change itself.
So if you follow the rise in CO2 levels in the air, do you also see a rise in pollen that correlates with it, like in the last 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, we have data for the last 15 years or so, and people are seeing this as they brush off their cars or see it on their lakes. We're seeing the seeds and pollen, we're seeing it, but in fact, we're seeing very unusually high counts. And some of this is the carbon dioxide. What's interesting is that there are synergies. So the carbon dioxide is affecting plants, but we're also seeing early flowering of plants. And in Washington and New York and up here in Boston, we had flowering of plants in January. And I think actually that was one of the turning points in awareness about really how disturbed the seasons were and our weather was. Another one being, of course, before that, Katrina. But at any rate, we're seeing early flowering of plants. We're seeing synergies among the diesel particles that come out of trucks and buses. So very high rates of asthma along bus and truck routes in Harlem and in Roxbury and so on. Turns out diesel particles are a good delivery system for these pollen and spores.
How can that be? What do they do to deliver it?
They deliver it deep into the lung sacs, and they actually irritate, they have nitrate in them, so they irritate the immune cells, so they increase the allergic reaction.
Okay. The particles from the diesel fuel get inhaled and the allergens attach themselves to those particles?
That's right. We've known that diesel particles themselves affect the lungs and can irritate them and cause allergic symptoms. Now it looks as if there's this, they glob on to these aeroallergens and help deliver them and sensitize the lungs to their impacts.
One of the things doctors have been investigating is why are we seeing such increases in the rates of people who have asthma?
Sure.
Do you think there's a connection between global warming and asthma?
Well, I believe there is. And there are several ways in which these various components are working. You've got the aeroallergens just from CO2. You've got diesel particles from burning fossil fuels as well. Then you have the change in the seasons. So climate change is affecting the seasons, and we're seeing early arrival of asthma and allergy season. Then there's another issue, which is ozone, the ugly ozone, the ground-level photochemical smog. And that's a reaction between tailpipe emissions that sped up with warming. So we're seeing warming counteract some of the attempts to reduce ozone. Then there's another one that's really hit us by surprise. We're seeing dust storms come off of Africa from where the deserts are forming that are the size of the continental U.S. And the desertification is due to overgrazing, but also to the warm sea surface temperatures that you've heard so much about. So we're seeing climate affect Africa. It's affecting actually China in ways that's sending dust storms to the West Coast. And in the Caribbean...
With the West Coast of America?
West Coast of America.
So the dust from the dust storms travel that far?
They do. They do. And they in terms of the Atlantic, they are seeming to be swept across along the same pathway of warm, salty sea surface water that's sweeping these hurricanes like Katrina and Rita and so on, is also accelerating the pathway of these dust storms. So they're reaching Barbados and Trinidad and also Florida, kids in Miami. And in these islands, asthma was unheard of. It was less than 1%, and that's why those of us from the north that could afford to would go there for clean air and so on. What we're seeing now is 25% of the kids have asthma on islands like Trinidad, studied by a woman pediatrician there. And they peak during these dust storms. The dust storms also introduce organisms that infect the coral in the Caribbean, the fan coral. So here's another dimension of climate and global change that's affecting our air quality. So we've got the carbon dioxide itself from burning fossil fuels. We've got the particles from fossil fuels. We've got the climate changing from fossil fuels. We've got the ozone from fossil fuels. And now the aggregate of climate change that's been created by this blanket of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases is contributing to the various components of bringing on seasonal change, as well as the photochemical smog.
You know, you mentioned these dust storms from mm-hmm. Africa being swept across the ocean and coming to the coast of the United States. Who's actually tracking where that dust is coming from?
These are tracked by NASA, our space agency. So we see them in the satellites, and where they're also being tracked now is in the deep oceans, where we see fan coral being infected by fungi that are soil fungi from Africa, and we've traced them with DNA and so on. So it's very clear that this is where they're from, and we're seeing, in terms of the clinical picture, the epidemiology, that they peak with the asthma peaks during these dust storms. So the whole connection with disease, as well as the diseases of coral, is a clear one, and we see it from space first off.
My guest is Dr. Paul Epstein, Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Paul Epstein. He's Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. You know, before we get deeper into some of the health problems that you think are being caused by global warming, let me just ask you a basic question. Why are you so convinced that we're actually experiencing global warming?
The oceans have warmed much more than the atmosphere. It turns out that over the past century, the oceans have warmed 22 times more than the atmosphere. And the oceans, as Andy Revkin called them, are the heat bank. They are storing the heat, and that is what is changing the water cycle. The oceans are warming, ice is melting, water vapor is rising. This is what's affecting our ecological systems and our health more than the warming itself.
More than the warming of the atmosphere.
Well, it is the warming of the deep oceans that is what generates the not just one storm, but the sequences of storms that and then lead to clusters of outbreaks of disease. It's the warming of the ocean that is helping to melt the ice at rates not conceived of just 5 years ago. They're accelerating and going twice as fast as they were some of the outlet glaciers in Greenland. This is what has us all alarmed, is the pace, the magnitude, the rate of change, the volatility and variability of weather, and the key is the heat that's accumulated in the deep ocean, which we missed. We missed when we looked just with satellites, and it wasn't till the science of the late 90s revealed with submarine data, etc., what was happening in the deep oceans. That's where the heat is.
I've spoken to scientists and science journalists who are confident that we're experiencing global warming, but they say that if you look at the pattern of events around the world, you could say this pattern is an example of the consequences of global warming, but you can't look at any one hurricane or any one event and say with certainty whether that one event is directly a consequence of global warming. Do you feel that you can look at the health issues that we've been talking about, like, you know, the increase in pollen levels, the increase in the number of people who are suffering with asthma? Can you look at any of those one things and say, this is definitely a consequence of global warming?
Well, I think in terms of asthma, we've described a number of ways that I do believe that climate change and the fossil fuel emissions are contributing to this disease. If one looks in the mountains of Africa, Latin America, and Asia at what's happening with malaria and dengue fever, we're changing to another type of disease, but there's a clear signal because there, just where the glaciers are retreating, where plant communities are migrating up, where the permanently frozen ground, the permafrost is receding, we're seeing mosquitoes circulate at high altitudes. And this means malaria is circulating in Nairobi. Dengue fever is up in the mountains of the Andes, etc. So it's in the mountains that we can see the clear signal that warming is affecting the range of infectious diseases.
Are insects particularly sensitive to climate change?
Insects are very sensitive to climate change. We see this in the when we do fossil records. They move faster than grasses and shrubs and trees and bears that are considered the paleothermometers, as they're called, that respond to changes in temperature. We see beetles moving much faster. We see this in terms of insects that are affecting forests. And they're moving from Arizona up to Alaska, overwintering. Some of these beetles are overwintering, moving to higher altitudes, moving to higher latitudes, and even sneaking in extra generations a year, just as the trees become weakened from drought, because it's the rosin in the trees that drowns out the beetles as they try to bore through the bark. Now, I'm telling you more than you want to know, but the point is that insect and plant life is just as important as the battle between insects and humans. And in fact, millions of years ago, it was that battle between insects and plants that resulted in the fossil fuel that we burn today. And it's a battle that is going to play out in terms of agriculture, in terms of forestry, and so on, in ways that may be more important than just malaria and human disease.
You've done field work over the years in developing countries. Do you feel like in your field work you ever directly observed epidemics or increases in illnesses that were correlated to global warming?
Well, in the 1990s, the huge storms were hitting Honduras, Hurricane Mitch, Mozambique was having floods. Venezuela, these are places I visited. As we move into the 2000s, we're seeing the same kind of storms at the U.S., Japan, and Europe. So the picture has magnified, as it were, and hit insured populations. But I've been to Mozambique, lived in Mozambique, and seen the aftermath of these extreme events. they leave malaria epidemics. Malaria went up fivefold after the 6 weeks of floods in 2000 in Mozambique. In Honduras after Hurricane Mitch, dengue fever, malaria, rodent-borne plague, and other types of viruses that rodents carry, and waterborne disease. So again, it's these clusters that I've observed in developing nations, and now we're seeing this affect us in developed nations.
So have you been trying to involve the insurance industry and various businesses, trying to convince them that they will have to pay consequences if global warming continues unchecked? And is your hope that if you involve them and if they see the consequences, that they'll try to contain global warming, they'll become part of the larger cause?
That's what I've been doing. I've been sitting down with the executive boards of Swiss Re, meeting with Munich Re, AXA Re. These are the reinsurers that insure the insurers, with AIG and large insurers that have now become more aware of the full range of risks of climate change and the biological as well as the physical. The disease and climate change are stalking our health and the natural systems we depend upon. These risks are being perceived in the corporate sector, in both industry and the financial sector. They are now beginning to look for how to develop their investments into healthy, sustainable solutions. This can now turn around and help us towards how we get away from fossil fuels, how we do not go down the nuclear path, I would say, and replace carbon pollution with radioactive pollution. These are the discussions we have to have now as to how public health can be front and center in terms of the new path of development.
Is it ever frustrating for you to, instead of working with patients, to be working with, you know, business and insurance companies, trying to convince them that they need to get on board and make changes, you know, and support changes that will help prevent the further global warming trend?
Working with the business community right now is exhilarating, and all of finance and the corporate sector are buzzing right now. We see venture capitalists putting money into this. The raters like Standard & Poor's begin to evaluate it. So I'm excited with this new patient. And I think that it's if one would do a PET scan on the brain of the global economy, it's all buzzing, the different parts of it, and it's getting ready to make some moves. It needs the enabling incentives and regulations to make the move at a scale that's commensurate with the pace and magnitude of climate change.
Have you succumbed to any of the health problems that you've talked about that you think are connected to global warming? More allergy problems, asthma, problems with mold, that kind of stuff? Not malaria, I hope.
Well, I've had some of these things, but the other day I got poison ivy cleaning in my backyard and fighting back this enormous regrowth of poison ivy and the toxicity, and I was suited up as if I was fighting Ebola.
Wearing a hazmat suit.
It was totally with stripes and strips of and so on. And then decontamination was a horrible problem. I had to get rid of this stuff and put it into. So it made me really think about fighting Ebola and getting rid of that waste. It made me think about nuclear and getting rid of that waste. So I got some poison ivy, if you must know, and this I realized that a roll in the hay, if you're thinking of a roll in the hay these days, you've got to think of more than a condom.
Well, Dr. Epstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Paul Epstein is the Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Jolie Holland's new CD, Springtime Can Kill You. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Lily Holland's new collection of songs is called Springtime Can Kill You. A former member of the rock band The Be Good Tanyas, Holland has spent the past few years making music that rock critic Ken Tucker says moves further and further away from anything resembling conventional rock or pop. Here's his review.
I'm flirting with the birds. I'm talking to the weeds. Look what you've done to me. I'm still.
Jolie Holland sings in a slurry murmur, as though you know the words she's going to sing before she sings them, that you share her mood and her point of view. And so why should she bother to enunciate when she can just talk softly into your ear and confirm your feelings? But chances are, you aren't feeling nearly as downbeat as Holland is throughout her new third recording. You have to be pretty down to call your album Springtime Can Kill You, don't you think?
Feeling my blues. I tear myself away.
Not tuned in to Jolie Holland's wavelength, she can seem mannered and forced. All these songs about being misunderstood, ignored by the person she's in love with, the self-pity and accusation in a simple line like, "Look what you've done to me." Holland has the blues, and she sings them as though she's staggering aimlessly down the street. Most singers of sad songs want you to think they're moaning from deep in the night, but there are a lot of birds in Jolie Holland's compositions. She's clearly a daytime depressive, an observant one, who looks up to the sky to confirm the worst, rather than navel-gazing or staring at her shoes. This is good for her work. It gives her a store of imagery and a sense of purpose that keeps her mannerisms in check.
Oh, the sun is too bright, and the mountains are too far, and there's nowhere in town I can get to. In my broken car, I've got nowhere to go but to sleep. I would shut my eyes, but I've got promises.
Holland, in her 30s, a self-taught player of guitar, piano, accordion, fiddle, and banjo, has an affinity for self-mythologizing singer-songwriters like Tom Waits. And as such, she can be pretty insufferable in interviews. When she makes music, however, what she calls her sullen songs, they take on the right edge of anger and self-righteousness.
But like a stubborn beast, while the barn is on fire, I might resist you when you try to save my life. I might resist you when you try to save my life. Well, I can't see that door.
my solace and my place. The walls are caving in, but I am still stubborn based. Why don't you talk?
Jolie Holland manufactures the best kind of phony baloney bluster. She constantly claims to regret having a perpetually broken heart, even as the greasy, glowing gleam in her voice tells you that she gets off on her sadness. She's that rarity, an insensitive singer-songwriter. She acts as though she doesn't care what you think, and in the process, makes you care intensely about her moaning and whining.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Springtime Can Kill You by Jolie Holland. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a classic arranged by Arif Mardin, a producer and arranger who was with Atlantic Records from 1963 to 2001 and helped create their sound. He died yesterday.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Letters from the Hive, An Intimate History of Bees, Honey, and Humankind by Stephen Buckman and Banning Replier. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org.
Tom York, the lead singer and songwriter of the band Radiohead. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.